Well, it might be just me, but it seems today, perhaps more than usual, that we're expected to have clear opinions on famous people. Who's the better royal consort? Is it Meghan Markle or Kate Middleton? Is Meghan just a social climbing diva, or is she a brave and audacious agent of royal change? Is Kate just a bland breeder? As one female columnist put it, ironically, on International Women's Day, those are not my words, I was shocked, called her a bland breeder. Or is she a refreshing picture of newfound royal stability? And it doesn't stop with the royals. In this age of the Me Too movement, we've been expected to come to firm judgments on the character of famous people who we've never met and whose fame makes very little difference to our lives. And sometimes we're expected to come to firm decisions on them before any of the allegations they're facing have been tried through proper channels, or perhaps even despite the fact that they have. What about Jesus of Nazareth? Some scholars claim that he's the most influential person in human history. In terms of fame, a few years ago, some boffins at MIT with a little too much time on their hands calculated the relative fame of a bunch of famous people throughout history. Now, they ended up putting Jesus at number 3, just behind. I wonder if anyone wants to take a guess. If Jesus is number 3, who would you put at number 2 or number 1? Just call it out. The Beatles. Nice try, but no. Any other guesses? Lots of options. Yell it out. Beyonce. Well, look, this is going to seem really bland and boring now, but it's actually Aristotle at number 1 and Plato at number 2. And then you've got Jesus, and then you've got Socrates at number 4. Now, the funny thing about that is everybody agrees that Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates were outstanding Greek philosophers. They were massive in terms of the development of Western civilization, to be sure, but they were Greek philosophers nonetheless. We know who they were. We know what they did. There's no great argument about it. The guy up there in their circle of fame, however, Jesus of Nazareth, well, he's much more controversial. You know, there's no running argument about whether or not Aristotle, Plato, or Socrates were the son of God. But that's the exact question surrounding Jesus. Christians believe he's the son of God. He's the Messiah, which means the anointed one, who was sent to save the world from its broken and sinful state. If you're not a Christian, there are a number of options, a number of opinions you might hold, but perhaps it's fairly safe to say the prevalent non-Christian view in our society is that he's just another religious teacher. Perhaps a very great one, an influential one, but just a religious teacher nonetheless. So I want to know, how can you be calculated to be the third most famous person in history and argued to be the most influential person in history with this extraordinary question raging on about your identity? Just a guy or God in the flesh? Who is this man? Who is he really? Now, you might say, well, Meghan, Kate, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, Beyonce, the Beatles, they don't really affect my life in the day to day. Neither does Jesus, so the question doesn't really matter. But the thing is, if he's the Son of God, and if what he taught in the New Testament is in fact his teaching, if then there's this question of eternal life, eternal destiny, the renewal of the world hanging in the balance, you might be able to duck the question, you might hide from the question, but it affects you nonetheless because it affects all of us. Well, in tonight's passage, we see Jesus' fame moving well beyond his hometown of Capernaum and even beyond the greater region of Galilee. Jesus is starting to become known at the national level. And people are coming from all over to hear him preach and to experience his miraculous power of healing. And beyond its growing scope, there are three things to notice about Jesus' fame. First of all, Jesus' fame is popular rather than official. We read in the first verses of this passage from verse 7 that Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake and a large crowd from Galilee followed. And when they heard about all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and the regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. But notice that word withdrew. Jesus' episode begins with him withdrawing. And it's as he withdraws from something or someone that a large crowd follows him. In other words, Jesus wasn't seeking this crowd. He wasn't building a crowd. He was, in fact, removing himself from a conflict situation. And if you've read the previous section, you know what it is. He had a growing conflict with the Jewish authorities. And it reached its zenith in the previous section where there was an argument about whether it was right or wrong to heal somebody on the Sabbath. He had healed a man's hand on the Sabbath, the holy seventh day of the week, which is a day of rest in Jewish tradition. And the religious authorities took the view that in healing this man, he had in fact broken the Sabbath. And so they began to look for a way to make him suffer the penalty of capital punishment. It might be hard for us to understand, but the Sabbath command was in some ways, it was really up there with, you know, it was in the Ten Commandments, one of the very, very most important commandments in Jewish law. And in the worst case scenario, certainly a brazen act of breaking the Sabbath was in fact a capital offence. Although by the time of Jesus, the law would not have been applied very often in that way, certainly not under Roman occupation. Jesus argued that even the Sabbath law allowed for an animal to be rescued on the Sabbath, so why then couldn't he heal a man who is worth much more? But he wasn't heard by the authorities, and so he withdrew from that conflict and his followers went after him. And so what this shows is that Jesus' fame at the national level was a popular movement. Official Judaism viewed him with suspicion and increasing hostility, and even now at this juncture, seeking his death. And the funny thing about that, it's not really funny at all, but we're only into the third chapter of Mark, and already the religious leaders want to bump him off. They seem to have acted extraordinarily hastily in their judgment, at least. So what do we do with that? This is the first thing we notice about Jesus' fame. There's this popular appeal that is massive and national. And officially, there's hostility and rejection. What do you do with that? Should we take the official line? Should we side with the authorities? Jesus is a religious lawbreaker. He's a rebel. He's leading the people astray from their Jewish heritage for his own reasons. And therefore, he's just another weirdo. Or should we take the popular view that whatever the fine details of Sabbath law, Jesus' teaching and miraculous power were clearly restoring a lot of lives, and you really can't argue with that? Popular versus officialdom. It's not always easy to answer these kinds of questions. Now, I've got no qualms about standing up here and saying that popular anti-vaccination theories, I think, are just destructive. Vaccinate your kids. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I accept the judgment of those who've done the research. I've been vaccinated. Probably most people here have been vaccinated. I accept the judgment of those who've seen the evidence in the laboratories and know what they're talking about. And I don't accept the judgment of those who haven't. You see, so I mean, you know, I go with the experts on that. I don't go with some popular movement against vaccination. I go with the experts. But you know, sometimes experts can get things wrong. Sometimes whole institutions that we might trust can go south. And we've seen the shocking example of that even in the church with the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Abuse. Not only the church, though, we've seen it in the banking sector with the Royal Commission into the banks. Sometimes the culture of an official institution can become corrupt. And chiefly, folks, sometimes whole institutions can stop listening. And I think this is what we see with the Pharisees. From the very outset, from the beginning of Jesus' ministry, they took an attitude of interrogation and passing judgment on him, but they weren't openly patiently pondering who this man truly is. So I'm not against experts. Christianity is not against expertise. And sometimes I talk to Christians who say, oh, don't bother with Bible college. You don't need to know the original languages. You don't need to really use your head. It's just you and God, your relationship with God, and it's about people. We don't need experts. But if there were no experts, you wouldn't have the Bible in your own language. You'd just be staring at it in ancient Greek. We need experts. But on the other hand, sometimes experts can go wrong. And sometimes the popular sense and instinct can be much closer to the truth. Well, what do we do with Jesus? What do we do with him? Well, you see, what Mark wants from us as we read this gospel account of Jesus is that he doesn't want us to side with one party or the other in a knee-jerk fashion. What he wants is for us to remain open-minded, and he wants for us to be patient as we spend time letting the story sink in. Jesus' acts, Jesus' words, his deeds. And he wants us to be patient. He wants us to be open. And he wants us to be prepared to be surprised. Well, Jesus' fame then is popular. The second thing we observe about Jesus' fame is that it prepares for the next phase of his mission. We read that instead of staying endlessly with this crowd, though they're pressing against him so much that he's forced out onto a boat in order to avoid getting mobbed, and presumably he continues doing some healings here. Instead of staying in that situation, he actually goes up on a mountainside and he calls to those to himself those he wanted, and they came to him. And out of that group of disciples, he appointed 12 of them that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. And we get their names there, the names of the 12. You see, the mountain in biblical imagery is a place of encounter with God. This is what Moses experienced when he went up onto the mountain. He met with God. And then later on in the times of the prophets, Elijah went up on the mountain and again he met with God. The mountain is a place, yes, of withdrawal from common life, but it's also a place of encounter and often a place of commissioning. And so this is what happens. Jesus goes up on the mountainside and he commissions these 12 to be his closest disciples, that they might be with him and that they might share in his authority and in his mission to go and preach the gospel and demonstrate the power of the gospel in driving out demons and healing the sick. You notice that these are called. This is Jesus' authority here. He called to him those he wanted and they came to him. This is a unique authority he has to turn around the direction of someone's life and to commission them for his service. Why 12 people? Well, one of the reasons, it seems that there is a symbolism here in the number 12. You see, there were 12 tribes of Israel. The people of God were in 12 tribes. Now, Jesus appoints 12 disciples to be his apostles. And the implication here is that Jesus is starting a new people, the people of God. Not divorced from the old people, of course, because they're all Jews themselves. But Jesus is starting something new with these people. They're the prototypical people of God. And Jesus is going to use them to spread the message of him throughout the world and to bring more and more people together to grow this fledgling community. Pardon my voice, folks. I'll see if I can get to the end before it gives out. A number of other reasons. These are to be eyewitnesses. They are to be close to Jesus so they can share with the rest of the world exactly who he is and what he does. I've mentioned that they're to be missionaries. And there's something else I want you to notice about these folks too, and that is that they are mentioned in individual terms. We've got Simon, to whom Jesus gave the name Peter. He's to be the rock on which the church is built. That's what the name Peter means. James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They're called Boanerges, if I'm pronouncing it right, which means sons of thunder. It could be a reference to their fiery preaching, certainly a reference to their zeal. Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, and you can read the stories of these individuals throughout the Gospels in the way that they're called. James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, perhaps because he was zealous or because he had belonged to a particular group, a political affiliation perhaps, and Judas Iscariot, who sadly betrayed him. Notice that each of these are mentioned as individuals. And if you know the story of them, they each have their own personality. Some of them are impulsive. Some of them are leaders. Some of them are supporters. But each of them has a job to do that nobody else can do. And this is what we find in the church as well. Jesus has called each one of us to be his people, and each of us has our unique personality. We have our individuality. We have our aspirations. We have our gifts. We have our strengths. We have our weaknesses. We have the unique storyline that has brought us to this place. For some of us so far, it's been relatively plain sailing. For others, we've experienced real brokenness and hardship. Some of us perhaps wish we could do our lives all over again. Others of us are full of optimism and just on the threshold of life, looking forward to the future. But the thing is, for each and every one of us, God has chosen us to use our individual story to serve him in ways that can only be done by us. So if you're here tonight and you don't think you're the ideal Christian, you're mistaken. The ideal Christian is about you being the you that God has called you to be. It's not about you being like anybody else here tonight. With all of your strengths, with all of your weaknesses, maybe you're always on time. Maybe you're always early. Maybe you're always late. Maybe you beat yourself up because you're not very creative. Maybe you beat yourself up because you're so creative that you can't control your creative impulses. Maybe you're an introvert. Maybe you're an extrovert. It doesn't matter. God has called you to do something that only you can do. And that's what we find with these 12. They're individuals, and each of them had a specific ministry. Do you know, we don't even know what all of them did. We hear a lot about Peter. We hear a lot about James and John. We don't hear a lot about the others. History tells us something. But it's only going to be on that final day when each one of us sees exactly why God wired us the way that he did and gave us the job that he gave us to do. But you can trust him with that. You can trust him with your whole life, past, present, and future. He is fitting you out to do something for him in sharing the gospel, in demonstrating it through the way that you live your life, in blessing others that only you can do. So Jesus' fame prepares for this next phase of his mission, preparing these 12 to expand the work beyond even the national level, even though Jesus' fame has reached that national point. Finally, and in summary, Jesus' fame intensifies the question of who he is. And this is the question that Mark's been asking all the way through his gospel, and he'll continue to ask it as we go along. He wants his readers, he wants us, those of us hearing this tonight, to ask the question seriously. Who is this Jesus? What do we do with this famous man? What do we do with him? He wants us to ponder it seriously without coming to a knee-jerk, superficial reaction. See, the Pharisees, they wanted to do things by the book. But you can see in their attitude towards Jesus from the very outset that there was a closed-mindedness there and there was an impatience there that ended with them so quickly baying for blood, wanting to apply the death penalty over a nuance regarding Sabbath law. They should have waited. They should have been more patient. They should have been more open. Jesus had a wonderful point. Yes, Jewish law even allowed a beast, an animal, to be rescued on the Sabbath. How much more valuable is a human being? But you see, the crowds are also an ambivalent phenomenon too. They're very enthusiastic. They're mobbing Jesus. But they don't know exactly who he is. They're not there because they really know. They're there because of the power that he demonstrates, because of his healing authority and the wonder of his preaching. But crowds can be fickle. Popular movements can go this way or they can go that way. Never side with a crowd just simply because it's an exciting movement to be a part of. you never know what they're on about. I remember 10 years ago, there was the Occupy Wall Street movement. And this was, of course, against the greed of the banks on Wall Street, the financial institutions that had led us into the great financial crisis. Now, someone decided, let us then do the Occupy Melbourne movement. And I remember this because it was near the time of my ordination. I was spending a bit of time at the cathedral, and you had Occupy Melbourne out the front of the cathedral on Flinders Street. But they didn't know what they were on about. They were against something. They were for something. But what was it? I went there and they were playing Pink Floyd, We Don't Need No Education. So what are you protesting here? See, there was a sense of excitement. There was a sense that there was something that should be continued on from the Occupy Wall Street movement. But by the time it got to the streets of Melbourne, there wasn't a lot left. Crowds can be fickle and crowds can be confused. They can be ambiguous. Mark's not calling us to side with a crowd. And he's certainly not calling us to side with the demons. The demons, ironically, are the ones who get it right. You're the Son of God. But Mark is not calling us to give credence to the reliability of demons. What Mark wants us to do is enter into the perspective of the 12. They go up on the mountain. They respond to Jesus' fame by spending time with him to get to know who he is, to listen to his teaching, to be open-minded, and to go on a several-year journey patiently learning that he is, in fact, the Messiah, the Son of God, but not what they would have initially expected. We need to do the same. We need to enter into that kind of posture that the 12 disciples enjoyed. It takes patience and openness to spend time with Jesus. Be open to the possibility that he's going to surprise you with who he is. Knee-jerk reactions are not the way forward. You know, the busyness of our lives, the polarization of the media, social media, the virtue, the seeming virtue of getting outraged on social media for one cause or another, a lack of nuance, the valuing of mere anger at causes as a sign of moral superiority. All of these things get in the way of the kind of patience and the openness that we need if we're going to come to the right judgment about who Jesus is. Well, the gospel teaches that God showed us his patience and openness in Jesus. He's the man who spent 2 years of his life patiently bearing with people in all of their flaws, patiently bearing with the 12 that he chose, even though they made mistake after mistake, and even one of them betrayed him. His patience went all the way to the cross. His patience continues today because today, you and I have the opportunity to respond to him in faith and repentance. We've had 2,000 years as humanity to think on who this person really is. What extraordinary patience God has shown us. Let's make the most of it. Let's redeem the time. Patience and openness is what we need. Jesus offers us a way out of the knee-jerk reaction when we see his patience and his openness to us. But the question must be answered in closing. It must be answered because of the nature of his claims. And the only way to really try the question is to spend time with him through this record that his 12 disciples have given us. Read the New Testament. Read the Gospels. Read them all the way through. As you do so, you might consider a couple of additional steps. You might read the Gospels through in the context of a mentoring relationship in which you can develop that openness that comes through conversing with another person and having your preconceptions challenged, even though you have the opportunity to challenge others. And you might also open yourselves to God in basic acts of prayer. You don't have to be sure in order to pray. You can pray a doubtful prayer. You can pray a prayer of confusion, asking God that if he's there, would he give you clarity and the truth about this person of Jesus? What would our world look like, folks? What would our world look like if people practiced the kind of patience and openness that Mark and Jesus are asking for here? What would our lives look like if we practiced this kind of openness and this patience? What does Jesus' fame mean? Spend time with him. Look into it. Journey with him. May you find Mark's answer to be true, that he's the Son of God who came to serve us by saving us from our sins. Amen.